MSU Today is online at SpartanPodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Spartans head baseball coach Jake Boss.
We have joining us Jake Boss, the head baseball coach here at Michigan State. Came back to mid-Michigan in 2008, took over a program that was challenged, and had some infusion from Drayton McLean and a new baseball stadium that's kind of been the gem of an old college field project. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
When I grew up in Lexington, up in the Thumb of Michigan, as a child, I took two railroad ties, buried them in the ground, took some chicken wire and spanned it between the two, created a backstop, built a field, and would play baseball with about 30 kids that lived close to me there. No coach, no structure, no travel team, just played baseball.
Right.
And in today's world, everything is structured. It's striving to be on the travel team. It's parents following along very closely. Good or bad for the sport?
I think a little bit of both. You know, I think certainly parents supporting their kids and showing that passion for their kids, I think, is extremely important. I was fortunate to have that growing up. I don't think my mom missed a game, you know, from my little league career all the way up to, you know, playing through my college career and now even, you know, coaching. The only time she didn't come to games was when I was working in Iowa. And ever since, she's been at just about every home game that I've had, whether it's been here or in somewhere else. And so I think that support is extremely important. At the same time, I think, you know, we as parents need to let our kids be kids. And, you know, I've got three kids of my own. And I think it's important that they understand that it's a game, especially at this level. And they need to treat it like a game. And within that framework, I think there's a lot of things that they need to learn on their own that I'm not going to, you know, jump in and teach them right now. And whether that be handling failure, and in our sport, that's an awfully big part of what we do is handle failure. Handling wins and handling losses in different situations where, you know, they may be confronted with, you know, my son last night was playing in a football scrimmage and there was a little scuffle there, and it was interesting to see how he was going to handle that, you know. And I think all those things are things that they need to learn while they're out there competing, and certainly when, without me or my wife, you know, stepping in and trying to handle that situation. And so I grew up the same way, Mark, and the dents in my parents' siding and the back of the house prove it. We were playing, every day in the backyard and learned a lot about how to compete and how to have a good time and really how to grow. And so, I think there's a little bit of good and bad to both, though.
If you think about your own children and there is a need probably to be part of more organized sport. Growing up in a small town, I threw a baseball at a shed. Now, my prospects weren't too strong in those days because women weren't exactly have a good career path. But in small towns, you could still participate in sports if you were good enough. And I think it was very important for me. And I know you have girls, and so it's very important for them as well. But if you think about the wear and tear on kids now as well in these organized sports so young, what advice do you have from just a perspective of making sure that they have the energy and to last through what is a long time of sports?
Sure. Well, I think first and foremost, I think do as much as you possibly can, you know, with regard to playing different sports, you know. And I think we see it in our sport a lot where it's turning into, in some cases, a year-round sport for, you know, for kids that are 10 years old. And I think that's a shame because I think they're missing out on a lot of opportunities to be put in different situations in other sports. And I think that's, you know, that's important. You can't, you know, we tell our recruits the same thing. You can't replicate standing at the free throw line down one with 2 seconds to go, you know. And I like our guys to play as many different sports as possible, and I think that's important for kids. And I think, you run the risk of getting burned out, you know, or you run the risk of getting you know, feeling like you have to play because mom and dad want you to play. And I think at that point, it's really too bad. You know, and you go back to your childhood, I think, you know, the fact that you were able to build, Mark, a field in your backyard, and the fact that, you know, President Simon, you were throwing a ball against a barn, you know, I think those things, I think, really teach that type of work ethic to young people, and the idea that if I want to do something, I'm going to have to go get it done myself, and I'm not going to wait for anybody else to do it for me. And I see that in my kids a little bit sometimes, where, you know, they're you know, something might be too hard, you know, right now, or we're not going to pursue this because it might be a little bit too difficult. Instead of the idea that, well, if I want to get better, I have to take the responsibility and be accountable and do it, you know, do it myself. And so, you know, that's what we're trying to teach them. And I think, you know, the more things that they can be exposed to, the better.
How do you think that college baseball has changed over the years, and what new challenges do you face as a college baseball coach?
Well, it certainly has changed, I think, for the better in most respects. You know, I think the popularity of the sport right now is that it's is an all-time high. I think what's happening in Omaha with the new stadium and the College World Series and the publicity that we've gotten, both, you know, with the College World Series and the Big Ten Network, has really been a huge boost for our sport. The challenges that we face, especially in a northern climate, are you know, have really always been there. And I think the idea that, and, you know, we were fortunate last year to get an at-large bid to the NCAA tournament. I think the tournament committee really saw some things in a different light maybe this year, not only with our program but with a few others nationally in the north, that, you know, we can compete with anybody at the end of the year. And it's tough early on when we have to go outside for the first time and play against teams down south that have been outside all year. And that's, you know, that's not easy, but it's a reality, and it's what we do, and our kids don't know anything else. But, you know, there are some challenges, and there are some things that are being talked about with, you know, some changes in reform and things like that, and we'll see what happens. But that's probably the biggest challenge right now, is being able to compete early.
Some of the things that you and your father have done internationally are remarkable. Missionary work overseas. How gratifying was it to you to see Uganda compete in the Little League World Series?
Really neat to see. You know, it's and I think the neatest part about it was, indirectly, my father probably had a hand in that somehow a long time ago, because he's been to Uganda, and he was in on, you know, really the grassroots effort of bringing baseball into that country, and was able to work with a couple men who in turn worked with a couple more men that, you know, got that program, you know, started however many years ago. And so very gratifying. I know it was for him, too. I think it was a kind of a chance for him to puff his chest out a little bit. But, you know, he's been to Africa several times. He's been all over the continent. I've had a chance to go to South Africa, but, you know, he's been to Uganda and Kenya and Malawi and you name it, and really promoting, you know, not only his faith, but the game of baseball. And to see Uganda there, you know, I think is, again, is just an opportunity for him to think that, you know, he had a small part in that.
What advice do you have for parents as well as for parents of young kids as well as for college kids about how to deal with that balance of academics and athletics?
Well, it can be a difficult balance. You know, there's no question, because you're being pulled in a lot of different directions. And, you know, I think we have a lot of young men that really do well when there is that structure there, and it's a busy time, and they know that they have to be at class at 8 o'clock and at 10 o'clock, and they have to be out at practice by 2. And when that day is really filled up with a lot of activities, they seem to do very well. And I don't know if that's just the culture of athletics, or I know for me, that's I feel like I have a better handle on things when I'm organized and when I know when I have to be, you know, at a certain place. And so, you know, once fall practice for us is over in the middle of October, guys get a little bit more free time, and that's when, you know, you start to see maybe we really have to monitor the academics, because at that point, with that free time, you know, there may not be as much motivation to work as hard in the classroom at that point in time, and they may have, feel like they have a better handle on it. And so it's a difficult balance, but it's certainly attainable.
I think one of the tensions that the NCAA faces, I think all of us, is how to give kids this unstructured time, because they do need, as you said earlier, a break, mm-hmm. and they don't need to have the coach sort of in their face all the time. Are feeling the pressure of competition, at the same time having structure and then no structure and then trying to go back to structure is a very difficult set of circumstances for people who are 18 years old and are trying to navigate the shoals of living away from home for the first time and everything else. And I think it's one of those things where we haven't probably structured all of the rules in the right way to keep some of that structure, and at the same time potentially gives kids the space they need just to take a breather.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, on the one hand, I completely agree, and they are 18 years old, and they're just, you know, getting into figuring out who they are and who they're going to be, and you know, with that, there's, you know, there needs to be a little bit of freedom for them to do that. At the same time, I remember when I was 18 years old, and you know, it was you know, that freedom of not having to go to class if I didn't want to go to class, and not realizing the ramifications of that in December when that report card was sent home. And well, so that's part of the, I think that's the neat thing about this job, is that I have the opportunity to have young men come in to our program as young men and leave as young adults, and watching and aiding in that process as they grow and how they balance, you know, the schoolwork and the academic work, and really preparing them for that career when they're done here, whether that be in baseball or in business or in education or wherever it may be. I think that's the neatest part about our job.
The thing I appreciate about you as a coach, getting to know you and others on Team MSU, is that it's not about simply the game. It's important. It is about life and the life skills. And it does take a lot of energy and time to spend with each of those, in your case, young men, in other cases, young women, to sort of listen to them, listen to their rhythm, and try to find not simply a team balance, but an individual balance so that they can grow and develop. And you had the advantage of your father, who probably nudged you at home in a way, and now you have to sort of create that family atmosphere,
right,
with people that are right now not your own sons.
That's very true. And, you know, during the recruiting process, I try to make it very clear, especially to parents, that I'm an extension of them. You know, and that's the biggest part of my job. And my job is to take care of our players. And you know, by taking care of them doesn't mean that, you know, we excuse anything, or, you know, that may mean there's discipline involved if need be. And you know, it's, you know, an extension of raising them for the next 4 years and getting them ready for life after Michigan State. But again, I think that's the neatest part about the job. And there's so many things that you get to go through together. When we came here, I really wanted to center everything that we did around that relationship piece, and knowing that, I think the neatest thing for us is when a young man walks into the office after being gone for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years or 10 years or however long it may be, and a young man like Eric Roof, who was a senior our first year at Michigan State, now wanting to come back and get into coaching, and he's in our office every day. And I think that piece of it, that relationship piece of it, goes far beyond any wins and losses that we have.
So let me ask you one final question. So you've had a lot of experience in baseball around your father and other institutions. What was the biggest surprise coming to Michigan State?
Biggest surprise, probably the way that a big university and nationally, you know, with national recognition, how it operated here and how close and as cliche as it may be, the family type atmosphere that we have here was honestly the biggest surprise, because I worked at several other places that was not even close to the atmosphere and the relationship piece that we have here. And the fact that, you know, you have, and it starts from the top with you, and it starts from the, with Mark, and you know, our most visible programs, the fact that Mark D'Antonio comes to baseball practice to speak to my guys, the fact that Tom Izzo is standing next to the bus shaking every kid's hand before we get on it to go to the NCAA regional, and their help in recruiting, and you know, and it just, you go right down the list. You know, we're fortunate. I look up in the stands and I see, you know, several members of the coaching staff, you know, watching our games, and we do the same thing with their sports. And that was the biggest, really, surprise for me, because I think at this level, you know, you can, it's very easy to get very single-minded with your purpose and what you're trying to do with your team, and you kind of think the world revolves around you sometimes. And realizing that there is support here from every aspect in the university, from the president's office all the way down to you know, to the equipment managers and everybody else in between that are involved with our program, really was the most pleasant surprise also.
The way I'd like to close this is a request for you to share a story, and that's when you got the job and the interaction you had with your parents, who unfortunately or fortunately were out of the country at
right,
the time.
That's true.
And how that evolved.
Well, my dad was I got the Eastern Michigan head coaching job in November of 2007, and my dad was still coaching at Lansing Catholic at the time, and I had asked him to come down and be my volunteer at Eastern Michigan. And he was going to finish up that 2008 season with his team and then and join us that next fall. And we went through the season. We had a good year. And my parents were celebrating their 40th wedding anniversary, and they were taking a two-week trip to Greece, of all places. And during that time, they left. I lived in Ypsilanti, close to the airport. They parked their car at my house. We took them to the airport, and they were gone. And during that time, those 2 weeks that they were gone, the job opened up here, and you know, everything moved very quickly, and was fortunate to be offered and accept the job here at Michigan State, and that all happened while my parents were still gone. Now, my dad, my mom does not have a cell phone and refuses to get one. My father had a cell phone but didn't take it with him, and he left it in the car, so they had no idea what was going on. Even when they landed in Detroit, when we went to pick them up, and I had gotten a job here, they still had no idea what was going on. And so I had to tell, we had two kids at the time, and I had to be very stern with my kids. I didn't want them to let the cat out of the bag. I said, "You're not going to say anything to Grandma and Grandpa about this." I probably scared them too. But we were in the car. We picked them up from the airport, and we were in the car driving back to my house and talking about the trip and what a great time they had, and you know, seeing the Acropolis and you know, Mount Olympus, and you know, doing that whole tour just was a thrill of a lifetime. And I'll never forget it. We were on I-94 back to my house, and my dad says, "So what's been going on here? How's recruiting going and things like that?" And I said, "Well," I said, "you know, there's been a change at Michigan State." And he said, "What happened?" I said, "Well, the former coach has resigned, and you know, they were looking for a new coach." And he said, "Well, what's the deal? Did you put in for that job? Did you make a run at it? Well, I mean, what's going on?" And I had the website, Michigan State website, on my BlackBerry at the time, and I just tossed in my BlackBerry in the car, and I said, "Push the button." And he pushed the button, and there was the headline was, you know, Jake Boss is named new baseball coach at Michigan State. And I think he thought it was a joke at the time, and my mom didn't know what to do. And so that kind of stole a little bit of their thunder from their trip, but at the same time...
Well, it's good that they visited Sparta.
Exactly, that's right. It's exactly right. But, you know, at the same time, the press conference was supposed to be that day. Mark and Shelley and everybody, you know, delayed it a day so my parents could be there. And, you know, President Simon, I appreciate you being here. It was a really neat day, and... they were just, you know.
I think they were still in shock.
They were, yeah, they were, you know, coming off of a high of a great trip together and celebrating their 40th wedding anniversary, and then really seeing me get my dream job here and coming back home was really a thrill for all of us. So
what are they going to do in the aftermath of their next trip?
Well, I don't know. We'll we'll see. I don't. There's probably not going to be another grandchild on the way, so that one's out. But yeah, we'll see. He's enjoying his retirement right now, and. I'm sure he'll be at practice more often than not, just sitting in the front row and watching things this fall. But we had a great time.
Good. It's great.
We're so proud of you in all aspects of your life. Great to have you here.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity. Yep.
Thank you.
That was Spartans baseball coach Jake Boss talking with his boss, Spartans athletic director Mark Hollis, and with Michigan State University president Luana K. Simon. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
Turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio, turn it up, so you know, radio.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the Michigan State University Alumni Association. And if you're the parent of a Spartan, there's no better gift you can give than a lifetime membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. Joining the MSUAA family opens the doors to our network of over 500,000 Spartans who'll help you feel right at home wherever you go, who can help connect you with Spartans on the inside, who can help you grow in your career. People who give you special treatment just because you're a Spartan. And an investment in a life membership in the MSU Alumni Association doesn't just add value to your Spartan life. It helps Spartans everywhere build more competitive skill sets and move more quickly in the direction of their dreams. Learn more about an MSUAA life membership online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The Michigan State University Alumni Association. Your personal network for life.
The University Research Corridor, empowering Michigan.
This is an association of the three research universities in Michigan to really collaborate on a deeper level than we have in the past and highlight for ourselves and for the region and for the nation the strength in technology, innovation, new research, investment that we think is going to help change the Michigan economy.
That's University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman.
The mission of the URC is no less than to help transform the Michigan economy and to make this a vibrant place that young people will want to come and stay, that businesses will want to be in, because we are a place where a lot is happening and we have the brain power for the new economy. It's here. It's in Michigan. We just need to tap it.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
So Michigan is vibrant. Michigan has all these things, and we want to signal that to the entire world.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, a new academic year has begun at Michigan State University, and that always coincides with our annual visit with MSU President Luana Simon. And this year, especially interesting freshman class coming in, the largest in MSU history.
It's true. It goes to show you, if you do statistical analysis, what an error of about 1.5 to 2% might do for you in large numbers. It's really an exciting time for us. We had projected in the range of 7,400 to 7,600 freshmen. We knew that we needed to begin to pull down the enrollment a bit, simply because of lab facilities and the things we wanted to make sure that we were providing value to students. And all of a sudden, the numbers popped up. But if you think about, again, large numbers, it's about a 2% change in yield. And most companies can't predict their sales that closely. But it is also the other thing that's really interesting about it, if you read all of the public press, listen to radio and TV, you would say that people are skittish about higher education. And we knew going into the year that people were applying to more places, that people were even going to multiple AOPs to determine whether they were going to get a value for their dollar in education. And so everyone we admitted we know can be successful at Michigan State, so that's the good news part of it. But then everything broke high in terms of the yield. Mm-hmm. So that would suggest that as people thought about the value of their higher education dollar, that Michigan State was something that they thought was necessary for their kids.
And we talked about this in the past, President Simon, but these young people are coming to Michigan State not wondering about whether MSU is MSU Spartan Green, or but expecting that.
They are, and they're from a generation that has grown up with, you know, hybrid cars and concerns about being green and recycling. So they bring their own experiences to campus, and they, I think they select institutions based on the fit of their own values about what they want to do in college in terms of academically a particular program, but also the environment and culture of the college. And being green is important.
Being extremely important. Being green is important down in the city of Detroit, too. And there are so many things that we can talk about since we've last visited. But let's talk a bit about this new memo of understanding between Michigan State and the city of Detroit, which has global implications as well.
It does. And we're very fortunate to have faculty of great passion and foresight. And the team that's leading the Metro Food Plus group includes our endowed chairs. This is not sort of a project off to the side, but something that's really integral to their research programs. And this goes with the sort of MSU approach of making sure that when we look at problems and issues, we sort of do it from the leading edge research, and we do it in new and innovative ways that have both a local as well as a global focus. So the team of Rick Foster, Mike Hamm, and Chris Peterson have been worrying about the issue of how we're going to be able to feed more people on the planet with shortages of water already around the world, and also that population moving to more urban areas where transportation of food will add costs, and also where we have to worry about food safety, food security in that transportation. And we have to worry about the cost of food and some of the food deserts that are emerging, not simply in what you would call decaying, if you would use that term, cities around the world, but also in emerging cities where the populations are outstripping the capacity for the city to build.
That vast migration from rural areas into the urban areas.
And that's really included. That's happening in Africa as well. Mm-hmm. So the idea emerged for this concept of how do you put together all of the factors that deal with health and nutrition, cost of transportation, how do you sort of grow food, how do you preserve food, how do you package food, and what kind of system would work that would chart a more dynamic and positive future for cities around the world. And Rick Foster and the team have identified this global food platform, and it's an extraordinary piece of work. And it, and typical of most faculty members, it would be written up, and there would be articles and everything else about it. It would get a lot of attention, and we're already part of a partnership of major cities around the world. And it, you know, we could have done that and sort of checked the box and said really great research, but we decided that it was important to try this concept out somewhere, and what better place to do it than Detroit.
Let's come back and talk a little bit more about this global food platform. I'm talking with President Luana Simon, Michigan State University leader, and we're talking about sustainability issues not only in Detroit, Michigan, but around the globe.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
MSU Ag Bioresearch is changing the face of science.
People should know that Ag Bioresearch is really the first front at MSU dealing with environmental issues and natural resources issues.
Dr. Steve Papke leads MSU Ag Bioresearch. More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
MSU Ag Bioresearch really is changing the face of science. If we can do that right, we create economic opportunities here in Michigan and opportunities for our researchers to make some really interesting discoveries.
Our goal is to generate economic economic prosperity, sustain natural resources, and enhance the quality of life for all.
We're MSU Ag Bioresearch.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu. MSU Ag Bioresearch is changing the face of science.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
We're back with MSU President Luana K. Simon to continue our conversations about some of the major issues related to global sustainability. President Simon, we were talking about what has become known as this global food platform. It occurs to me as you were talking, all the issues and dimensions of that platform, I mean, if you put those together, they almost define in a much more rigorous way what we talk about when we talk about sustainability.
I think it does, and it's not simply sustainability in the sense of keeping more trees,
right,
or things are more grass or more plants, but it really is how you put together the needs of people in the world and also the needs of the to preserve the environment and protect the environment, and how do you put those together in ways that aren't a zero-sum game.
Now, in Detroit specifically, what do you envision some of the initiatives will be? You mentioned food desert. We know that Detroit doesn't have the Detroiters don't have much access to healthy food. Yeah. We know that there are a lot of issues down there. What are some of the earlier initiatives that you think will kick off this program?
Well, as you know, Mike Hamm has been working with groups that are concerned about food in Detroit. And the question is, how do we align them? And also, how do we align them? And we're trying to do that with Flint as well, an alignment sort of that region in which we can make sure that the groups that are on the ground have expertise and the skill necessary to do the work that they've set out to do. And that's a classic land grant role. We also are working on expanding through MSU Extension, the work of Chris Peterson and the Product Center, to translate not simply growing food as a community activity or an activity of altruism, but an economic development activity, and how can we take food and food-related industries, particularly with a broad-scale ethnic population that has the capacity to take things that they find very special and translate into products that can be put on the stores of big places like Myers. And so Chris's work has been for the state, and now it's we've added a person in the Eastern Market to begin to serve people in Detroit who want to sort of turn their idea into a business and a food-related business. And I think that augments the tech support that's there for technology companies and some of the other things that are part of Detroit. The third piece, then, is to think about Rick Foster's global food platform. Mm-hmm. And how do we think differently about land use, and the ways in which technology can bring jobs to Detroit. So an example would be they're working with a company that is some new ideas for hoop houses. Mm-hmm. Now, hoop houses are pretty standard, but they're...
We have a few on campus.
We have a few on campus. They're not, and there are a few in Detroit. Then they're usually sort of bands of metal and plastic.
Right.
But those don't work very well. They don't last very long, and they don't necessarily provide the growing season we need to meet the food needs. So he's working with a company who has an idea about a different type of cover for hoop houses that he thinks can be produced in an inexpensive way and will extend both the types of crops that can be grown as well as the growing season. So the idea of the global food platform and the work of Chris Peterson is to bring that innovation and try it in Detroit. And if it works, it could produce manufacturing jobs for this product in Detroit and in Michigan. So it's not simply sort of just a neat way to see if something grows food better. It's a way of thinking about how we build on to food in agribusiness and technology development, using the vast array of engineering talent and agricultural talent in Michigan to think about a new way of doing business. There's also, if you think about urban agriculture, there are new different needs for equipment. Now, everybody, a rototiller works, but
you
a
can't bring a combine typically into the city of Detroit.
Or you can't even be, you know, even tractors that are developed, you either have to sort of use your rototiller, which is not very productive, even if you have a very, you know, a modest-sized piece of land. It's not a very effective weeding system. There are just a lot of things that can be developed that are new implements and new tools that fit better in an urban environment. And Rick's working with companies who are interested in trying some of those things out because they see a worldwide market for those going forward. And then there's the question of vertical agriculture and how we can use buildings, other structures in new and different ways, and that has to be part of the strategic planning of Detroit.
Well, we're talking a bit about food systems here and preserving humankind. How about food for the soul? Sometimes in sustainability, we forget a sociocultural dimension. We don't do as much with that. You've got a new museum that's going to be launched at Michigan State University, the Eli and Edith Broad Museum. Mm. We've talked to a few museum directors, but that is another form of sustainability that's very important, and there are also global dimensions as well. What an exciting launch this is going to be. What can you say about it right now?
Well, I think that it is going to be very exciting. I'm glad we're at the home stretch of getting it built. When you build a design that has so many unique and difficult components, which is why it's, I think, going to be an extraordinary attraction and in and of itself an economic development component because people want to come and see the architecture. And then the art will be blending towards contemporary, but it'll be the only contemporary art museum that will regularly hang old masters next to contemporary work and think about their juxtaposition.
And provide historical context for some of the
Because all here. As I reminded somebody who said, I only like this period of art, I said, well, that was contemporary once upon a time. So it's just historical in our context, but it was contemporary and cutting edge and a little bit viewed as unorthodox at the time. And so it's a matter of getting that perspective both on the evolution of art but also on the evolution of the ways in which art has displayed the human condition. And then we're going to be very international, so the opening will have the flavor of international, which is Michigan State University.
Well, the international dimension is really neat because there are several venues around the world that are going to be doing things simultaneously, and these are going to be simulcast. So, I mean, in Istanbul and other places around the globe.
Not only
that's amazing.
Not only that. Well, that's the world of technology now. So and also there are international artists who will have their work at for the Broad opening. So it's going to be really fun and exciting, and it's a project that I think. Similar to the Wharton Center, because we're the 20th largest ticket venue in America that people take for granted now, but was a very bold statement in a time of economic difficulty in Michigan and has proven to be extraordinary for the community, and I think the Art Museum will have the same.
Well, some take it for granted, but I'm sure you were pleased by a recent editorial in the Lansing State Journal that I think the writer said, couldn't imagine the Lansing area without Michigan State University.
Yeah, it was a nice.
It was very nice.
It was nice to say.
President Simon, I've got to ask you this question, too. We've talked about some very important issues related to sustainability. We've talked about water population control, land use, growing food, all of these things. Does it bother you as much as me that in the political discourse and in the presidential campaign, we hear very little about sustainability from either candidate, and not just at the presidential level?
Well, I think that that probably suggests that it's not top of mind for the American people, because I think they're talking about issues that they think are both top of mind and will a particular answer will sway people in their direction, and that's really the nature of political debate, unfortunately, in our country, I think today. It's hard to know. I mean, if you look at track records of people, you would call neither are anti-environment or anti-sustainability. So each of them have things that they can point to. The way in which the Utah Olympics was built was designed to be very caring of the environment. when it could have been very damaging to the environment.
Right.
So obviously there's an interest,
in
sustainability in the broad sense. You look at the Better Building Initiative, a whole range of other things that you would say from the Obama administration, and you can find the same things. I think our challenge as a society is words like sustainability have taken on a very divisive element.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we have to figure out what that really means to people and why it's valuable for mm-hmm. people. And I was in a conversation in a small town in Indiana recently, and the question about all this data about global warming. Mm-hmm. And probably the worst mistake people made was labeling it global warming instead of climate change
instead
in the beginning.
Change.
And it was done for political purposes mm-hmm. to gain attention to the issue in some dramatic form. But I think it's backfired in the way people think about understanding what we're talking about. So what I said to folks is, let's assume that we were the dinosaurs. Okay? And we were sort of roaming around the earth, you know, and there were glaciers all over the place by I guess, scientific data that would show that ice was all over the place. And we were thinking, you know, gee whiz, you know, the world's going to stay this way. And, you know, something happens and the weather got a little bit warmer and my food sort of went away. And I said, well, you know, it's okay. You know, just come back. No problem. And, you know, what if a few of us died over here? Those things happen. And that's just the cycle of life, you know. And you can do The Lion King and you can get a sense of the cycle of life. And you say, okay, you know, that's what it was. But I said, but sort of like for the dinosaurs, it didn't quite work out that way.
No.
And
it's a good analogy.
Okay, it didn't quite work out that way. And so the question is, could the dinosaurs have done something, you know, mm-hmm. That could have bent that a little bit, not necessarily changing the natural evolution of the planet, but could have bent it a little bit. And I think what we're looking at with the data, you know, in my way of thinking, because you know, in my simple way of thinking about it, because I'm not a climate scientist and I'm not really have the expertise to delve through all of that data and sort of say this is right and this is wrong. The way I think about it is, so what's the kind of error you want to make? Okay. And so my sense is if it really is a natural evolution of things, you know, then maybe we can make it better. And maybe we can figure out a way that if the ice caps do melt, that they go a little bit slower because unfortunately we've sort of built a lot of things on the coasts of
yes.
of America. And gee whiz, you know, if it is a natural evolution and we're just going through one of those big periods where the weather gets hotter and there are more El Ninos and it'll settle down no matter what we do, gee whiz, we got all these crops. But what if it isn't? What if it is something that we can control? Shouldn't we try? Mm-hmm. Because if it's inevitable, can we bend the curve in ways by using the data that are available that make it better for people's great-great-grandchildren to have the same choices we have.
So don't get bogged down in how much of it is human causality and how much of it is natural. Let's see what we can do to mitigate it.
Mitigate it.
Using science.
Because if we're wrong, I mean, if it really isn't natural and it really is human, then we can fix that part. That's an error that's fixable. And but you don't want to go back and sort of say, gee whiz, the dinosaur should have did something, you know?
And even if it's natural, there are things that we can do to slow it down
or mitigate it because we've added a lot more people to the planet. I mean, nobody knows exactly how many people we were designed to hold.
Right.
But we know we've added a lot.
And we're adding 9 billion.
And yeah. we're adding at an exponential rate, not necessarily in the United States, but on the planet. So how do we know what number is the right number, you know? And when we have to be able to make some mitigation to accommodate what's the natural growth.
Yeah.
Or the natural need for people to have a better lifestyle, or all these kinds of things that were not sort of envisioned necessarily in a place with no people.
Very interesting perspective on the climate change, quote, global warming debate. I'm talking with MSU President Luana Simon. President Simon, I'm just going to throw out a few topics, and if I could just get some quick comments from you on sort of where your thinking is. You just did the climate change, global warming. We'll do a few more here, sort of ask the president kind of a segment. And the first one would be much in the news, and a lot of these are in the news, China. Jack Liu's doing a lot of work over there and others at Michigan State. Are they serious about alternative energy and controlling some of the pollution issues over there? Are they going to be a major player in the green energy revolution?
Well, your guess may be as good as mine on that. I mean, they're like, I think, any country, any human society. You can point to examples that they're clearly taking advantage of the Green Revolution, and you can point to more coal plants, and people would say that's not the Green Revolution. I think that they see green as a part of their long-term strategic plan. And how it balances out, it will be like any implementation of strategic plan in different parts of the country and in different ways so that they can propel economic growth. It's no different here.
How about natural gas? A lot of talk about horizontal fracking, major economic opportunities versus environmental challenges. Where are you on natural gas?
Well, the research from the Department of Energy would suggest that there are ways of doing this that can preserve the environment, but it adds cost. And so I think there's a balance here between energy independence and security and how we essentially exploit our own resources. And I don't know quite how that balance is going to come out, but I don't think it's I don't think the extremes of that position are right. Either extreme is right for America.
Where are you on electric vehicles or hybrid vehicles or these alternatives, as they say?
Well, I mean, the MSU fleet has a lot of hybrid vehicles.
I know.
Because they really are extraordinary in terms of the value of the product, put it in that terms, in terms of price, life cycle cost, resaleability, and the energy savings. So that's a good both environmental play and economic play. And I think we have to be able to figure out ways to do both and not do it in an artificial subsidy way. And I think that the hybrid is an example of not artificially subsidizing the marketplace in order to get a short-term
and ultimately benefit. The marketplace will prevail in terms of what kind of cars people are going to buy.
I think they will. I mean, people will make their own choices. There's not going to be a force that says, gee whiz, this community has to have a certain proportion of electric vehicles. It's just not going to happen. So the value proposition has to be there. And part of that will be personal statement. And you're prepared to pay a lot of money for a car that
I do love my car.
Well, that you love.
But that's me.
That's you. And those choices should be available. The question is, can we make it an easier choice for people? And without artificially propping up things in ways that it's not sustainable. And I think there are probably new technologies, new ways to do that.
Right. Last question, then we'll conclude. I mean, you've been very good with your time this year. And I do like to remind people that this whole Greening of the Great Lakes phenomenon was originally a concept that you and Mike Feasey came up with, I think, up on Mackinac Island about 6 or 7 years ago.
We did.
Can you believe it's the fifth year of this program?
Well, you've done a great job. So you and Russ Wright have just done a terrific job. And it's done what we imagined, which was to bring experts, which is not me, but experts in the topic from all different perspectives. And this wasn't a program designed to convince people in one direction. It was a program designed to provide people the opportunity to engage and understand various aspects of the issues and try to make their own choices about what's best for them today and what's best for tomorrow.
Well, what gives you hope for the future? What gives you the most hope for the future as you look at the sustainability of the globe?
Well, I think these are really bright young people who are coming to Michigan State. And when we say to them, you know, this might happen in 2050, that sort of means something to them.
Right.
In a way that 2050 doesn't mean much to me. But it means something to them and personally, because they plan on being around then. And it also means something for their children and the life after them. And so I think that perspective of having real meaning, as well as growing up with some of the symbols of being green, which include recycling that we never would have done before, that's economically strong, hybrid vehicles, other things that are just something that they take for granted. And they like the gadgetry of having, you know, smart grids that turn off things. And so they're into that infrastructure. And they're into 2050 as being real. Mm-hmm. And so the combination of those two things plus the expertise that they can gather will let them, I think, chart a course that hopefully will be easier to have economic viability and prosperity as well as sustainability.
As one of our faculty members, leaving the planet richer in life and possibilities than the planet that they found.
And I think we all began that way. Mm-hmm. But I think for our generation, if you think about it, even the measurement of some of the issues that we're talking about didn't occur
right.
Until we were sort of older and set in our ways. So for these kids, it's right there now, and they're going to have a chance in the university to test those theories and measure and do things.
Well, I've been talking with MSU President Luana K. Simon, our annual get-together at the beginning of another great year at Michigan State University. President Simon, thank you so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
You're welcome, and thanks for your leadership.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to a 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
MSU AgBio Research is changing the face of science.
People should know that AgBio Research is really the first front at MSU dealing with environmental issues and natural resources issues.
Dr. Steve Papke leads MSU AgBio Research. More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
MSU AgBio Research really is changing the face of science. If we can do that right, we create economic opportunities here in Michigan and opportunities for our researchers to make some really interesting discoveries.
Our goal is to generate economic prosperity, sustain natural resources, and enhance the quality of life for all.
We're MSU AgBio Research.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu. MSU AgBio Research is changing the face of science.
Turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio, turn it up, so you know, radio.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.